After the paper, we always had an original composition by someone. We simply called them originals. The original might be an essay, or it might be a short story, or it might be a poem or poems. It could be long or short, so long as it was, original. By late evening, and then there was general conversation after the papers, generally about the papers and then about anything. By late evening, the conversation would have ranged far and wide. And it was there that I first heard the best of Wild Bill's stories. There were light refreshments, of course, and plenty of good cigars and much black coffee to drink. Oh, the crowd wouldn't break up until certainly 12, sometimes 1 o'clock in the morning. It was there that I learned to enjoy a good cigar. There was a particularly delightful Bar Panatella made by Roy Tan. Fortunately, I've always associated cigar smoking with the social intercourse of scribblers, and so when it ceased to exist, my smoking did with it, except very randomly. And then after I had buried my friend Kennan, who died of lung cancer, I lost all my appetite for tobacco. The coming of social fraternities, as well as World War II, pretty well killed scribblers. The death of Bondi was also a heavy blow. He was the one who made it his business to check up on our proposed members, to make sure they were really interested in creative writing, would look on the election as an honor, and would be, to use his favorite word, clubbable. After he died, we fell into a habit of letting some of the older students who were particularly going to law school nominate their law friends. The rest of us, in other words, didn't go to the trouble of looking out for and recruiting suitable members. Now, a law student having been in school 4 years and being in the midst of law, his law courses looked on scribblers just as another organization whose pen he could wear and an organization which he could put on his yearbook, whatever you call it, description of his career. And they didn't take much interest in scribblers. And with the coming of war and the disappearance of students from the campus, the club disappeared. And may I brag a little bit? In 1924, I was at one and the same time president of Hermium, president of Alpha Phi Epsilon, and of Scribblers. I never felt so important since in my life. I can't resist telling about one of the papers I wrote to. I thought it was first class. I called it The Scientific Aids to Pedagogy, written under the pen name of Phineas P. Azelslager, in which I took the grades of one of Dr. Kennan, a semester's grades of one of Dr. Kennan's enormous astronomy classes, and the grades of one of my large business math classes. And by applying a suitable, good-sounding analysis to them, showed that you could derive a curve, which would describe what I call the longitudinal diffusion of knowledge, which would absolutely fit the curve of the grades in the seats numbered serially from one in front of the professor to the back of the room, and explain its shape. It contained a coefficient of competence which would enable you to evaluate the academic competence, the knowledge of his subject professed, held by the professor. It would enable you also to compute the coefficient of diffusion, which would measure the vigor with which he was able to present his work. And it would also permit you to measure what I call the introversion coefficient, which is a measure of the unwillingness of the average student to sit up too close to the professor. I thought it was pretty good. And I showed it to one of our professors in the School of Education once, and you know what he said? He says, "That's a magnificent paper, Lewis, and what magazine are you going to publish it in?" In the spring semester of my senior year, Dr. Hume called me in and asked if I would be interested in teaching a section of freshman algebra that spring. I was so flattered I would have done it for him for nothing. But they were going to pay me $75 for that semester's work. Now, if that sounds small to you, remember that that $75 would almost pay my board bill for the entire semester. When I reported to Grandma Tari, he handed me the textbook with the pages turned down while I was to start and end the semester, and turning to the class says, "This is Mr. A. B. Lewis. He is a fine, upstanding Christian gentleman. I am sure you will all get along well together." And with that, he walked out of the classroom and closed the door. I thought then, and I still think, that that was a non-productive indoctrination to the teaching profession. And when I got to the place where I could, I tried to do something about it. I had hoped to get that same teaching job my first year of graduate work, but I didn't, for a variety of reasons that I didn't understand at the time. But Dr. Kinnon managed to give me a housekeeping job around the department, and my sister, coming through on her promise, loaned me the money for my tuition. And so I came back to get a master's degree in physics. That January, Dr. Kinnon's graduate assistant, Arnold Scott, left to take a job in Washington, and Jim Hardy and I took over as graduate assistants in his laboratory. The next year, we were offered jobs as full-time graduate instructors, Hardy in physics and I half-time in mathematics and half-time in physics. I had one lecture section of pre-med physics, and even I have to admit that it wasn't a howling success. I got an answer to question in sound late in the semester. Describe the characteristics of a musical sound. And the student answered, "The characteristics of a musical sound are melody, harmony, and rhythm. Melody is indicated by the lines on the sheet and harmony by the spaces in between." Dr. Hume, however, offered me his class in analytical geometry. I was flattered. It was his favorite subject. He had given me, or made me earn, I'd rather say, a Taylor medal in it when I took it, and I was proud no end. But he was most helpful to me, helping me with assignments, advising me about making out tests and examinations. And on particularly sticky points where I wasn't too sure of myself, he would patiently go over the material with me in his office. He must have spent an hour with me on the general transformation of the general quadratic equation. This involves a translation of the origin of coordinates and a rotation of coordinate axes so that the general quadratic is transformed into one of the forms of a standard conic section. The next day, while I was busily engaged going through this business on the blackboard in class, I just happened to turn around, and there was little Alice standing in the open door watching me. When he saw that I saw him, he gave me that little possum-like grin of his and an almost imperceptible nod of approval as he quietly stepped out of sight and went on his way. I truly believe our graduate instructors would give better instructions to our freshmen if they had more of this sort of help and more of this direct supervision of their teaching efforts. I followed Dr. Hume's routines of frequent, almost daily, blackboard work and of frequent tests. I once had a roommate who said that he frequently woke up in a cold sweat because he had dreamed he heard Dr. Hume say, "Well, young gentlemen, we'll all go to the board today." But I am proud to say that for that class of mine, for no member did the average of his daily grades, his four test grades, and his final examination differ by as much as one letter grade. I had one really jarring experience that year with Dr. Hume, and it did me good. Hardy and I took analytic mechanics from him. Now, Dr. Hume was an engineer by training, and it was a sheer pleasure to see his elegant development of the principles of mechanics at the beginning of each chapter, and his almost effortless solutions of the problems, and his copper plate drawings, that's a mixed image, with chalk on the blackboard. In fact, Hardy and I enjoyed the exercise so much that we didn't study enough, and we flunked his final examination. When we sheepishly went to him to see what we could do about it, he gave us that little grin again and said, "Well, I really can't imagine what happened to two such good students, but I think I can hold off Dr. Longus for 1 week. Would you like to try again?" Well, you never saw two people work harder. We stayed in the physics building until midnight every night, working together on the blackboard until we practically memorized the first half of that textbook, and we had no trouble with the makeup examination. That was a valuable lesson to me, and I never forgot it. It's well that I did so. When I got to Hopkins, I found that some professors used no textbooks at all, just lectured. And yet they hit the ground running and let you keep up if you could or wanted to. Hardy and I got our MA degrees at Ole Miss in June 1925. Hardy's thesis was on the astronomical telescope, and mine was on the specific heat theory and a new method for measuring the specific heat of liquids and solutions. It wasn't much of a thesis, mine was, and yet the experience turned out to be of much assistance to me when I worked on my doctoral dissertation, which involved, believe it or not, the theoretical computation of the low temperature specific heats of the normal alcohols. The graduate school here had not yet been organized, and I graduated under the direction of a graduate committee. I checked the library once to see if my thesis, which antedated the graduate school, was still in existence, but it wasn't there, so it must have been lost. a greater blow to my ego than the scholarship in general, I admit. All of this time, I'd been firm in my insistence that I would not be a teacher under any circumstances, and therefore I applied for a job at the National Bureau of Standards and had taken the appropriate civil service examination. I was about to say applied for a position, but at that time in Mississippi, any salary-paying job would have sufficed me. And let's not ask whether I would have found fulfillment in it or not. Those were some examinations. There were two of them. There was an every 8-hour day, no time out for lunch. Or rather, if you took time out for lunch, it was time out of your examination. Dr. Kennan accepted them in lieu of my comprehensive examination here, I'm glad to say. And it took from November 1924 to December 1925 to get a return on them and a job offer back. On graduation in the spring of 1925, then, I was offered a job as assistant professor of mathematics and physics, which I accepted, of course, until my job in Washington materialized, if it ever did. In retrospect, it's obvious that the promotion was quite unjustified. It simply verifies the maxim of my friend Abby Cullen, which is that virtue is nearly always rewarded, particularly if your friends or stooges are strategically located to look out for your interests. I had two friends looking out for me, Little Allie and Wyatt Bill. But I did receive an offer, finally, and reported for duty at the National Bureau of Standards on January 2, 1926. The story of the next 10.5 years are not germane to these reminiscences and are of interest to my children, and maybe my friends only. For the amusement of my children, I have taped them under the name, in imitation of some of Defoe's novels, The True Story of a Small Town Mississippi Boy, How He Came to Washington, D.C., and there met a tall, blonde girl from the Shenandoah Valley, and what ensued therefrom. I was conscious of the Bilbo shakeup, but not really aware of its real impact on the campus. I was much too involved in my own affairs. Then, trying to ride out the Great Depression, struggling with frozen bank accounts, reductions in force at Standards, pay cuts, payless furloughs, etc., etc. But Dr. Hume did return in the fall of 32, and visited Washington on some business or other, and met with and addressed the rather unstructured group that called itself the Mississippi Society. It was a rather emotional equation, with much huffing and puffing from the men and some discreet tears from the women. Dr. Hume's youngest son, William, had come with him for the purpose of entering Hopkins. And that day, William visited us at Standards. There were three Ole Miss men there at the time, or maybe four. During the lunch break, we sat out on the grass and talked at length, mostly about Dr. Hume. William was full of how glad Dr. Hume was to be back at Ole Miss and how much he loved the place. We talked about how good a teacher he was and how much he had meant to the school and how universally he was admired and respected. And we philosophized, as young people are apt to do, about what success really is and what a man ought to expect out of life. And we were all in agreement that whatever success in life is, Dr. Hume had managed to achieve it. Without my realizing it, that conversation simmered around in my subconscious mind for the next 2 years. By 1934, this feeling had developed into a very distinct feeling of malaise. My working conditions were pleasant. I was rather proud of the skills I was developing, the people I worked for. They were gentlemen, everyone. They were my personal as well as professional friends. And I was beginning to produce a rather respectable trickle of scientific papers, both in the general literature and in the House Journal of the Bureau of Standards. But something was lacking. By comparison with Little Alley and Wild Bill, my friends in the Bureau simply weren't in the same class. I knew, for example, that if I stayed on to retirement, my then bosses would shake my hands, wish me well, pull a new card out of the civil service personnel file, and put a new occupant at my desk. And I felt vaguely that that wasn't exactly what I'd like to anticipate. That is to say, I realized that what I really wanted to do was to come back to teaching in general and to Ole Miss in particular. I guess it was just in my blood. So I talked it over with my wife, and she loyally said, "All right, if that's what you want to do, let's get our affairs in order and we will go." Before coming, we sat down and discussed all the material disadvantages of teaching. Its low salaries, its long hours, the sometimes tedium of freshman courses, and so forth, as against the pleasures of good students, the intellectual freedom of shaping your own courses, the general academic atmosphere, the desirable environment for raising children, and so forth. And we agreed that if we deliberately chose to enjoy the latter, we would never complain about the former. We have stuck to that decision, and we have found that it relieved us of much fussing and fuming that some of my colleagues have gone through. So I began to write around, and presently an offer came through from Dr. Kennan for a joint appointment, assistant professor of mathematics and physics. Looking through the catalog, I saw that there were three men in the departments where I would be teaching who were already assistant professors and who had master's degrees and no more that were 5 or more years old. It was my guess that at this date they were not going any further degree-wise. I honestly hoped to be something more than assistant professor, at least someday. And I reasoned that it would be better to come back ahead of these men rather than to leapfrog over them after we had established some kind of personal relationship. So I held out, and the university finally came through with an offer as an associate professor at the magnificent salary of $2,400 a year. That was a cut of $300 from what I was getting at Standards, but I had a realistic appreciation of the financial resources of the university and didn't quarrel about the money. If the record existed, it would show that that was the first as well as the last time I ever mentioned rank or salary to anyone at the university. So we shipped our furniture, packed ourselves and our three children into our Model A Ford, and made the 1,000-mile trip home. I never looked back, and I never regretted the move. The campus had changed in those 10 years. In my day, the campus had ended at the row of three houses just to the west of the Lyceum. Two were still there in 1982. The middle one, where the Williams Library now is gone. It had been occupied in my day by Professor Heddleston, I think, and had been, I think again, the original Steward's Hall. Now in 1936, there was a graduate building, Bondurant, the cafeteria, Johnson Commons, the hospital, Guyton Hall, and I'm not too sure about the older dormitories facing south and between the cafeteria and Guyton. But I do believe that the three of them, just to the north of the cafeteria, were in place. And, oh yes, the gymnasium. Back in my day, all that area was woods. I went on a possum hunt wiener roast with Lorraine Teat once out there, and we treed a possum and roasted our wieners just about where Guyton Hall now is. The central hall of Lyceum had also been opened up. In the 1920s, when you entered the first floor Lyceum from the east, you faced a blank wall in front of you on that north-south hallway. There was a door on your left, and the whole first floor of the center section of Lyceum was occupied by two chemistry laboratories, inorganic and organic, extending across the entire width of the building. The stock room was a sort of lean-to in the space between the main hall and the north wing. I suppose the organic lab had an entrance or exit from the building to the west, but I have no memory of ever going around there, and I'm quite sure the colonnaded facade was not on there when I was a student. In a way, the faculty looked pretty much the same. The old-time stalwarts were all there in place. There were some new faces, of course, but all the billboard appointees were gone, with one exception. I'm told that Dr. Hume insisted that all these political appointees be removed, with the exception of the one case that he considered not to have been politically motivated, and I'm sure the university regretted that decision in later years. This is probably not the place to tell about Chuck Trotter's experience with Little Allie at that time, but if I have sufficient space on the last tape, I'll put that in there. Five new faculty men came in that year: Wolf, Hutchison, Silver, Nicholson, and Lewis. Dr. A.B. Butts had just become chancellor, and I sensed a current of uneasiness running through the faculty. Dr. Coulter had just become dean of liberal arts. Now, Dr. Hume had been a known quantity, quiet, reserved, a man of such complete integrity that you could almost predict his reaction to any given situation. Dr. Butts, on the contrary, was cocky, aggressive, and voluble, and an unknown quantity. In particular, he had laid down the dictum that all department chairmen had to have terminal degrees. How many were involved, I do not know. I remember only three who got their degrees either then or immediately thereafter: Howerton, Hammond, and Hull. I don't know either how many of these were in the slow process of working out their degrees and merely accelerated the process when Dr. Butts came in. I do know about Frank Hull. We had contact with the first Mrs. Hull, who had been Marguerite Chapel. Dr. Clovis Chapel was a very prominent Methodist minister who had been in Mount Vernon Place Methodist Church in Washington, D.C. That gave us a contact with the herd, and our acquaintance soon developed into quite a friendship.